Hello, and welcome to the Corporate Transparency Act of 2021, Ramifications for Businesses and Their Owners webinar presented by Polsinelli. Today's webinar is being recorded and will be available for replay within 24 hours on our website. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab located next to the speaker bios. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Polsinelli shareholder Bill Quick.
Thank you, Emma. As Emma indicated, my name is Bill Quick, and I'm a member of Polsinelli's Corporate Transactions Practice Group. I spend most of my time advising family offices, real estate investors and developers, and other clients with portfolios of business entities. And I do so with regard to establishing operating fund formation, corporate governance, financing, refinancing, buying, selling, dividing, et cetera, basically managing their pool of assets. So I also speak and write frequently on some of the esoteric aspects of corporate practice like today's session. Larry Harris is also on our panel. He's a member of the Corporate Transactions Practice Group and spends most of his time working with community banks, providing a range of advice from general corporate services to formation, mergers and acquisitions, and regulatory support. Larry is also a member of Polsinelli's Corporate Finance and Securities Practice Group and regularly assists community banks and other smaller companies in private securities offerings. Peter Waltz is a member of our Securities and Corporate Finance Practice Group. His practice focuses largely on assisting public and private clients in capital raising transactions and securities disclosure and compliance matters. In his practice, he also often advises early stage companies in organizational matters and financing transactions, as well as parties such as fund sponsors, brokers, and financial advisors in security compliance matters. Janine Campbell is Polsinelli's business department paralegal manager and has oversight over the firm's other business law paralegals. She is frequently involved in and relied upon in complex mergers and acquisitions transactions, especially transactions in the healthcare industry, owing to her expertise and significant experience. So with that, thank you for joining us today for this session. It is timely and interesting. There's been a huge response to this seminar, a little more than I even expected. So obviously it's hit a nerve for people. So we will jump right in. So the first question is, why are we here? The reason we're here is the U.S. Congress passed the Corporate Transparency Act, which we sometimes refer to as the CTA. And it was part of the 2021 National Defense Authorization Act. And the purpose of the Corporate Transparency Act is to combat the use of shell companies in the commission of money laundering, financial fraud, and other domestic and international illicit activities and corrupt practices. And since we've all been stuck in a pandemic, many of you probably have watched the Panama Papers on Netflix or seen articles or seen interviews about it on 60 Minutes. There's also the Paradise Papers and a number of other recent high-profile disclosures through WikiLeaks and some other third-party actors where they have drawn a lot of attention to this topic. Larry, did you have some thoughts you wanted to say with regard to the financial institutions and their Know Your Customer or KYC requirements as they play into the Corporate Transparency Act?
Yeah, that's great. Starting about 20 years ago, the banks were put basically in charge of finding out for the federal government a lot of information about money and who owns it. The federal government following the rules set out by Deep Throat to Woodward and Bernstein said, follow the money, and the money's at the banks. And so trying to figure out who owns an account is an important part of following where the money's going if you're going to find the people who are money laundering or financing international terrorism. And so the Know Your Customer rules came about. They've had other names, but Know Your Customer or KYC has stuck. And banks bore most of the burden for that. The CTA spreads that burden out to the companies that are now being created. But I think in the end, banks are going to find out that they end up being part of the enforcement arm of the U.S. government and making sure that companies comply with the CTA. So I don't know whether it really relieves them of much burden.
Yeah, I'd agree with you, Laura. I've seen some commentary that indicated that, you know, the reason for the CTA was to shift the burden of compliance from financial institutions to their customers. But I have a feeling that what's going to happen is it's just going to go back to the banks to, you know, enforce compliance on all this as well. So moving on, the reach of the Corporate Transparency Act is quite broad and includes incorporators and organizers, or what is referred to as applicants, that we'll be talking about a little bit later in the session, financial institutions and others dealing with many U.S. business entities, including with with regard to existing business entities formed prior to the Corporate Transparency Act's enactment, and we'll talk about that a little bit later as well. The Corporate Transparency Act requires certain businesses, including privately held and nonprofit entities, to report their direct and indirect human beneficial ownership information to the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network of the Department of Treasury, which is often referred to as FinCEN.
Hey, Bill.
Yeah, Peter.
Yeah, a point here before we move past this slide, really regarding the potential breadth of the CTA. You know, we had said at the outset that it's really intended to apply to, quote, shell companies, you know, companies with no legitimate business purpose. But, you know, as I read the act and think on it, it really doesn't just apply to these shell companies, you know, organized by folks like, you know, Marty Bird from the show Ozark or other bad guys who are setting up webs of entities to cover their tracks. It really has in some way going to apply to nearly all business entities with some form of U.S. touch point. I note that the federal government estimates there's something like 2 million new business entities formed each year. And as we're going to talk about, I think even existing and new business entities that aren't ultimately going to be a reporting company are at least going to need to do some form of filing. And I know a lot of the criticism of the CTA that was out there was really focused on its breadth and whether it was a, you know, arguably an overkill type act, i.e. it's too broad. And I think that's what's triggered a lot of the, or some of the opposition to it from industry groups or even the ABA.
I think that's a good point, Peter. I will begin by saying, you know, data is not the plural of anecdote, but I'll give you an anecdote anyway. I was home for Easter with my parents and in their home for the first time in over a year because of the pandemic and we'd all gotten vaccinated. And we were just talking, and my father had made a comment about, you know, how there were semis driving past our house all hours of the day because they live on the north end of town. And the semis were bringing grain from the grain elevator out to all the hog confinement facilities surrounding my hometown, which has 1,300 people. So, you know, of course, I was thinking about the Corporate Transparency Act, so I started peppering my dad with questions. And I said, well, you know, Dad, how many people does the grain elevator employ? And he said, well, I think it's, you know, maybe 30 to 40 people. And so, well, you know, are those independent contractors, the employees? Because I think they're all employees. And I said, okay, well, are they the largest employer in town? He said, no, it's probably the school. I'm thinking, okay, well, schools are exempt from the CTA. So, well, what's the next largest after that? And, you know, he was kind of having trouble, you know, he said probably the bank is the most after that. And I'm like, okay, well, banks are exempt. You know, what's after that? And then after that, you know, it seemed like it was, you know, five employees, six employees. So of this town of 1,300 people, there are 144 businesses in all but, you know, maybe five of those businesses have under 20 employees. And most of those businesses also likely have under $5 million of gross revenue. So as we get to the criteria of what is a reporting company and what isn't a reporting company, you know, the employee number and the revenue number are both factors that can kick you into the Corporate Transparency Act. So the short part of this story is, you know, probably 95% of all the businesses in State Center, Iowa, town of 1,300, have to comply with this Corporate Transparency Act the way it's currently written. You multiply that by all the small towns, medium-sized towns, small cities, larger cities in the U.S., there are a lot of people that are going to get swept into this, and most of them have no idea it's coming. And it's still unclear as to how they're going to be made aware of that, if it's through their bank or through their CPA or some other method. So I don't want to get too bogged down on that. We want to get you the details of what's in the act, so we'll move on. So the Corporate Transparency Act was promulgated on passed into law on January 1st of this year. If you'll remember, it was over President Trump's veto. And as part of that act, it established reporting companies, which is a defined term, and reporting companies that are formed after the effective date of the regulations that are going to be issued this year have to make a filing at the time of formation of those entities. Any reporting company that was formed or registered before the effective date of the regulations, which means every business that's currently in place now and anything that is formed between now and when these regulations are promulgated later in the year, will have 2 years after the effective date of the regulations to submit their report to FinCEN. So by January 1st of 2023, all businesses in the U.S. that qualifies reporting companies are going to be required to have data on file with FinCEN at the Department of Treasury related to their beneficial ownership. So as I said on the consideration here, there's no grandfathering of previously formed entities. So this is going to have a very broad sweep.
And Bill, I think
yes.
too, even companies that ultimately aren't a quote unquote reporting company are going to have to submit a filing to so they can certify to the government, gosh, I'm not a reporting company. So even if they're not swept into this, they're going to at least have to go through a little bit of brain damage to figure out how to submit the filing and let the government know why they think they're exempt.
No, that's a good point, Peter. The act itself doesn't really talk about having to file any report if you're exempt. It just says that you have to file a report if you're not exempt. But I think when the regulations come out, and based on some other things we'll talk about later in our program, you know, the reality is that you're going to have to make some kind of filing to attest that you're not an exempt corporation. An exempt reporting company.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah. So the next slide is just kind of more what don't we know, which sometimes is helpful, even if you don't have an answer. So what will the report contain beyond the discrete personal information that has to be disclosed? You know, this report is designed to have meaningful information in it. And it, you know, under most or many organizational structures, there may be a lot of levels of business entities between the asset holding entity and the ultimate human beneficial owners of those assets. And it's not clear how those intervening levels are going to be reported or if they're going to be required to be reported, but I would think that you're going to need to have some nexus that shows the connection between the asset level reporting company and the ultimate indirect beneficial owners. Otherwise, it's not going to be meaningful information in the database. So
hey,
how
Bill,
will the report
Larry.
Be yep. Go ahead, Larry.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment. There's a lot that we're going to say we don't know, and part of this comes out of FinCEN has released an announcement saying that we're going to be proposing rules, and we want comments to questions that we have, and they have a wide-ranging set of questions, very open-ended. And so just the extent to which that they're asking questions and seeking comments suggests that they don't know exactly where they're going to go on a lot of these things. And I think we have a link to the advanced proposal, announcement of the advanced proposal, and people who are interested can submit responses to FinCEN on their questions.
There's a beneficial owner information reporting requirements advance notice of proposed rulemaking that was sent out by FinCEN under the direction of the Treasury. We can certainly either post that link or get that to anybody who's interested. Just shoot us an email and we can forward it on. The response to that request is May 5th, which is about a week, 2 weeks from now. There will likely be some other opportunities to weigh in. Certainly there will be opportunities once they issue the proposed regulations before they issue the final regulations. My suspicion is there will be a lot of feedback on this. And even the questions that they've proposed in their advance notice of proposed rulemaking that's come out already, there are a lot of questions that I think should have been in that request that weren't. So I don't know if FinCEN hasn't gotten to the point where they've started to realize those deeper level issues that are going to be there, or they want to get the initial responses and kind of proceed in that manner. So some of the other issues, you know, how will the report be structured? We don't have any idea. Presumably FinCEN is going to give us a report to complete. I don't know if it's going to be a paper report that you have to, you know, paper file. I suspect it may be something like an online click through document, but we don't know yet. Also, indirect ownership can implicate a lot of intervening entities, which I mentioned a moment ago. You know, the question whether it's going to be a virtual or physical filing, and who is going to be responsible for making the filing, those are open issues. And who within a reporting company is obligated to do the reporting, you know, and for that matter, who's exposed to possible penalties, including potential prison time if things aren't filed that should be filed or inaccurately filed based on knowledge that's inaccurate. So the CTA is largely silent on these and many other matters, and they're all being deferred to the to-be-issued regulations. So bearing in mind, those regulations have to be issued on or before January 1st of next year. So those regulations are coming down in the next year, and we'll have to respond. So maybe the good news is the sequel to our program today is probably going to be better than the original, unlike most sequels. So, you know, one question you're going to ask is what personal information has to be reported and for whom to FinCEN. Each report delivered under the CTA is going to be required to identify each beneficial owner, which is a defined term, of the applicable reporting company, and each applicant, which is a defined term, acting with respect to the reporting company. And those human beings will have to have disclosed, presumably on their behalf by someone else, their full legal name, their date of birth, current as of the date on which the report's delivered, residential street address or business street address. I would assume most people are going to want to opt for the business street address, and a unique identifying number from the acceptable identification document or a FinCEN identifier. And Janine, can you talk a little bit about what this number entails?
Yeah, so the unique identifying number would be a passport number, driver's license number, other state ID, issued ID number, or the FinCEN number, which is a number that once you provide all your personal info, and I think we'll talk about this later, FinCEN would issue you an ID number.
Yeah.
So I think that people are really anxious to share, right?
Yeah, really.
To share and help be held in a database by Uncle Sam. Yeah. The FinCEN identifier, FinCEN hasn't really established how they're going to issue those or what you have to do to get one of those. My suspicion is it's going to be similar to like a known flyer identifier that you have with the TSA or like an EIN that a company would have. For their filings, I think it will probably be something similar to that, but it's yet to be determined. So I would hope that FinCEN is going to get that portion of this resolved sooner rather than later. And I suspect that a lot of people will opt for getting a FinCEN identifier and then providing that for third parties' use in reporting rather than putting out their personal information. particularly due to the fact that it may be that FinCEN ultimately isn't going to just accept an identification number. They may require you to send a photocopy of a driver's license or of a passport or something of that nature, which is what usually happens with your KYC disclosures with the financial institutions currently. So that adds a little extra level of queasiness when you're disclosing that, because it also has your picture associated with that number. So importantly, who's a beneficial owner? A beneficial owner with respect to a reporting company refers to an individual, so it's not another business entity, an individual who directly or indirectly, so indirectly can be pretty broad, through any contract, arrangement, understanding, relationship, or otherwise. So I like the "or otherwise" in here, really helps narrow things down. Either exercises substantial control over the entity or the reporting company, or owns or controls not less than 25% of the ownership interests of the entity. So as someone who deals with a lot of different businesses and business entities, that 25% of ownership is pretty ambiguous. If you have, say, an S corporation, it may be pretty easy to establish who has 25% or more of the ownership. But if you have a C corporation or a limited liability company or certain other joint venture entities, it can become very ambiguous as to what 25% of the ownership means. Is it 25% of the aggregate capital put into the enterprise? Is it 20% of the profits and losses derived from the enterprise? Is it 25% of each class of securities, if there are multiple securities in the enterprise? There are a lot of ways you can parse that. So just at the very start, the definition of who's a beneficial owner can be open to a lot of interpretation. And hopefully that will be narrowed some by the regulations, but I can say with confidence the regulations are not going to give you pristine answers on many of these questions, and there's going to be some judgment calls that are going to have to be made.
And Bill, I think that's even more true, or particularly true, with the substantial control element of that definition, right? Because that isn't defined in the Act, and that is something that it could be very broad and could vary by entity to entity or the context, or I'm just thinking of early stage companies that have gone through a venture round, and the equity holders have contractual protective provisions, et cetera. I'm just thinking that's the substantial control piece is going to be probably get a lot of action and comments and commentary and foot stomping as they go through the regulation process.
No, I agree. And substantial, does that mean control of the day-to-day activities of the business? Does that mean making major business decisions? Does that mean, controlling the purse and being able to distribute funds? Is that, if you have veto rights over certain things, is that substantial control? There's definitely going to be a lot of ambiguity and parsing that's going to have to happen to figure out how you want to report that if you're a reporting company, particularly in light of the penalties if you get the answer wrong.
Right.
So natural follow-up question is, what is not a beneficial owner? So there are certain individuals who are excluded from being considered a beneficial owner of a reporting company as laid out in the Corporate Transparency Act. One of them would be minor children if they have a parent or a guardian who's reporting on their behalf. One is an individual acting as a nominee, intermediary, custodian, or agent on behalf of another individual. Again, those are all kind of vague, amorphous concepts that may be hard to nail down. You have individuals acting solely as an employee of a reporting company and whose control over or economic benefits from such entity is derived solely from the employment status of the person. So under that prong of the beneficial owner that we're just talking about as far as substantial control, It may be that someone has substantial control owing to their employee status, but don't have an ownership interest in the company, so they wouldn't have to report on a reporting company. But if someone is an employee and has substantial control and has, you know, stock options or phantom interests or some kind of vesting interest that hasn't, you know, vested yet, or a de minimis ownership interest, but an ownership interest nonetheless, those are all factors that can quickly kick you back from being an exempt employee to being a beneficial owner that has to make disclosures. And some of these may evolve and change over the life of a business. You know, when you first form and start the business, is not necessarily the state in which that business will be for its entire life cycle. So you will have to be constantly revisiting these, presumably on an annual basis, to make sure that they continue to be accurate and complete. Additional parties that are not beneficial owners: an individual whose only interest in the reporting company is through a right of inheritance. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I'm sure we will get some clarification on that as time progresses. A creditor of a reporting company, unless the creditor exercises substantial control over the entity. So if you make a loan, if you make a loan and the loans, and you have a pledge of interest, if you collect on that loan and seize on the pledged assets, you might find yourself suddenly having to deal with the Corporate Transparency Act on behalf of that reporting company. Obviously, if it gets to that point in a business relationship, there are a lot of other things you're going to have to control on behalf of the company as well. So it may be a drop in the bucket, but it could throw you into that regime. And interestingly, it would make you responsible for the reportings that had happened previously and making sure that those were accurate, and to make a filing of any deviations from reality that you become aware of.
Hey, Bill, this is Larry. We have several questions. Three of the questions deal with who might be a reporting company, and we're going to get to that in a minute. So I'll raise those questions in a minute when you get to those slides. But someone else has asked, do you think an officer like a CEO exercises substantial control over an entity? And I think probably by definition, a CEO would exercise substantial control. The question is whether or not they fall into that exception that you were talking about regarding beneficial ownership, wouldn't you say?
I would agree. So if you are a CEO and you're just drawing a salary and that's it, or maybe a salary and bonuses, you're probably not within the definition of a beneficial owner. But if you have stock options, or you have some stock ownership or member interest ownership in the entity, or you have part of your compensation that's based on the profitability of the company, it could be that you then get thrust into being a beneficial owner under the definition.
And I would say that, you know, to the other part of the C-suite type officers, I think those people are almost certainly going to get sucked up into the substantial control prong. You're just thinking by analogy to SEC reporting regs and other FinCEN regs. I think absent, you know, unusual circumstances, think of your CEO, CFO, president, those type of officers as being in the substantial control prong.
I agree with that. So moving on from beneficial owner, we're going to talk about who's an applicant. You know, applicant was one of the other defined terms that falls within the reporting requirements for reporting companies. So an applicant refers, again, to an individual who files an application to form a reporting company under the laws of a state or Indian tribe. And so I'm assuming that what they mean by this is an incorporator or organizer, although that's not stated in the act, so that's an open issue. Or someone who registers or files an application to register a reporting company to do business in the United States by filing a document with the Secretary of State or a Indian tribal office. So one of the open issues here is, well, what does it mean to file an application? You know, I think a lot of the people on the phone here or on the moderator panel here have and will continue to serve as organizers and incorporators for for their clients. And I would suspect that those are parties that are going to fall within the definition of applicant and probably what was intended by applicant. But the definition says that it's the party who files the application. So just because my name is on a document as an organizer or incorporator doesn't mean I'm the one who physically filed that document. Janine or someone else at our firm may file that document on my behalf. Or sometimes, you know, Janine will forward that on to CT or CSC or some other commercial registered agent service provider, and they will file it with the state. And then the question is it the person who hits send on the electronic filing? Is it the person who physically delivers the document to the Secretary of State's office? You know, is it the bicycle courier that goes from CSC to the Secretary of State's office to hand them the paper document? You know, right now it's very uncertain as to what it means to be an applicant as far as a person who files an application. And I will say that the Registered Agent Services are very anxious about this. I'm a little less anxious because I know it's going to work itself out, and we'll deal with however it is, but that's definitely an open issue right now that's gaining a lot of attention from the people involved with the formation filing process. So under the Corporate Transparency Act, reporting companies is a defined term, and reporting companies are the entities that are required to report to FinCEN. And I think it's important to note, you know, when I was initially reading the Corporate Transparency Act, I kept seeing this term reporting companies, and I kept thinking of reporting companies within the securities law context, which are people who have publicly traded securities or report to the SEC under the Securities Exchange Act. But the reality is that those parties are actually exempt from being reporting companies under the Corporate Transparency Act. So what the Corporate Transparency Act refers to as reporting companies are the companies that have to report to FinCEN under this act, and they generally are going to be a very different class and caliber of parties. Peter, do you have anything you wanted to throw in there on the security side?
Yeah, I'll just add there, as you said, really the companies that are already 34 Act reporting companies are going to be excluded, as we'll see here in a slide or two, a lot of other entities that are already regulated by somebody and having to disclose beneficial information in some form. You know, public companies are one. Registered investment advisors, just another example, that are registered with the SEC or another, and so on.
Bill, this is Larry. Why don't I? We have three questions on who a reporting company might be or whether or not a type is. And I think it'll help. It's interesting because the three come up with three good points to see. The first question was whether or not a home healthcare agency would be a reporting company. The next one was whether insurance companies are required to be reporting companies. And the final one was subsidiaries of an SEC publicly registered entity. And if you think about what the purpose of the CTA is, it's to gather information on entities that the government doesn't know about already. That sort of helps guide you through this so that a home healthcare agency may or may not be a reporting company depending on the specifics of whether it's going to meet the criteria that Bill's going to go through on a reporting company, and those criteria are mostly, do we already know about you? Insurance companies are heavily regulated. They're regulated by the state in which they're formed. There's a lot of information known about them, and so you'll see that insurance companies are included in the list of those who are excluded from a reporting company, as well as finally, the subsidiary of an SEC reporting company is excluded as a CTA reporting company because we know a lot about companies that are registered with the SEC.
Yeah, as would any subsidiary of one of these other excluded, most of them regulated entities, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes.
Okay, I thought so.
So interestingly, this circles back to Peter's comment at the very beginning of our discussion. So if you are the subsidiary of an exempt company, then you are also exempt, but the act refers to disclosure or reporting by that exempt subsidiary in that they only need to include in their report the name of the upstream exempt entity. So if you read between the lines on that, that implies that the FinCEN is going to require reporting of the fact that you are not required to report, if I'm making sense on that. So although the Act doesn't specifically say exempt companies have to file a report, it's kind of implicit in there that you are going to be required to file something to establish that you are an exempt company and are not required to report. Again, that's going to get fleshed out when the regulations come out, I hope. So as far as, you know, what is a reporting company, the Corporate Transparency Act says a reporting company is a corporation, a limited liability company, or other similar entity, and other similar entity is not further defined. And then it says that is created by a filing of a document or formed under the laws of a foreign country and registered to do business in the United States by the filing of a document, or if you form the entity by filing a document with the Secretary of State of an Indian tribe, and is not otherwise specifically excluded. So the or other similar entity, I've seen a number of people weighing in on, well, does that mean a corporation or limited liability company or something similar to a corporation or limited liability company? Or is other similar entity mean any other entity that's filed or formed by the filing with a Secretary of State or a tribal office? So there's a fair amount of ambiguity as to what is meant by other similar entity. If someone were asking me today, I would assume that other similar entity being like a limited partnership, which you can't form unless you do a filing with the Secretary of State, a statutory business trust, which you can't form without filing with the Secretary of State, but it wouldn't include things like general partnerships or general trusts or things of that nature. So once you start going down the rabbit hole again, you know, there are some new hybrid entities out there, such as a series limited liability company. And in Delaware, and it varies by state to state how they handle it, there are a lot of permutations, but in Delaware, if you have a standard series LLC in Delaware, you don't have to file a separate filing with the Secretary of State to establish a series. You just do it, you state, I'm going to be a series LLC, and in the operating agreement, you deal with the series that you're establishing. But Delaware also allows you to be a registered series LLC, and if you're going to be a registered series LLC, then you file a separate filing with the Secretary of State to get that status. So it could be that, you know, a series within a series LLC that isn't registered in Delaware doesn't have to report as a reporting company, but a series within a series LLC in Delaware that is registered may have to separately report. And then you have questions as to what you have, you know, if you're a LLC that doesn't have registered series, then is the series LLC obligated to report for all the series within it as though those are part of the LLC, which they're not according to state law. So I just point that out in that there are a lot of wrinkles to this that are going to come out, and I'm not quite sure how the SEC is going to handle it. But one of the things that is interesting, and this is similar to how a lot of states handle, you know, doing business within a state, they don't really tell you what constitutes doing business in a state. They just give you some examples of things that don't constitute doing business in a state. Similarly, the Corporate Transparency Act doesn't necessarily say who expressly is a reporting company other than maybe any corporation, LLC, or similar entity. But they do give you a list of things that are not reporting companies. So presumably, if you go through this big list and you're not on it, then you are probably a reporting company. And if you go through the big list and you're on it, then you may be exempt, but you probably still have to do a little more analysis just to confirm that fact. So what I call the catch-all under the reporting company definition as far as exemptions, and we'll get into a little bit more of this at the end of the slides dealing with exempt reporting companies, because I think this is the one that's going to capture most people, is this requirement that if you have 20 or fewer employees and have $5 million or less in gross receipts and have physical presence in the United States, then you're exempt. But if you don't, you are not. So we'll talk about that in a second. So we talked a bit about securities regulated parties are generally exempt, the rationale being that there is already a lot of public information that's required to be disclosed for those parties. So there's less likelihood that you're going to have offshore nefarious actors using them to perpetrate their frauds. Similarly, utilities, public utilities and financial market utilities are exempt. Financial institutions are going to be exempt. They're highly regulated already. The question we had earlier, insurance providers, insurance companies, insurance producer entities with an operating presence at a physical office in the U.S. are exempt. Registered commodity exchange or registered futures trading entities are exempt. Public accounting firms that are registered under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act are exempt. If you're not registered under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, you may fall within the requirements of the Act, although you would still have the, you know, large operator exemption that we're going to talk about at the end of the slides. Pooled investment vehicles are generally exempt. Peter, do you have something you want to say on pooled investment?
Sure. Yeah, that one, you know, that one jumps out in my world, you know, dealing with fund sponsors and the like. So that term, I think, does have some nuance here. Really, the big one being is that the quote-unquote pooled investment vehicle to be exempt from being a, quote, reporting company needs to be connected with or operated by another regulated entity, such as a registered broker dealer, a SEC registered investment advisor, or a bank, et cetera. So, you know, I think it's just worth commenting on quickly that this pooled investment vehicle carve out is not going to capture things that some people might think of as being a quote pooled investment vehicle. You know, I'm thinking of joint ventures or sometimes SPVs or LLCs that may be used to pool money from equity investors that, you know, we sometimes see in financing projects in the real estate world and otherwise. So that exception is a little more narrow than might meet the eye as you're flipping through this.
All right, thank you. Nonprofits that had qualified as a 501c are generally going to be exempt. If you're not, then you are going to have to fall into one of the other exemption criteria. Subsidiary entities owned only by entities excluded from being a reporting company are exempt. Interestingly, you know, this fits within the wholly owned subsidiary category or subsidiaries that are jointly held by exempt organizations. But if you have an entity that has one exempt owner and one non-exempt owner, then you're still going to have to comply as a reporting company. But for the reporting of the exempt entity, you just have to list the entity's name on the report. Certain uncapitalized entities without activity or foreign owners, so kind of shell entities that you've set up and haven't put into operation yet, which is kind of interesting because a lot of times when you are forming entities as an incorporator or organizer, the client may not fully have the business model established or the capital stack in place, and it may be that that entity sits around for a while without having owners, So the question is, well, you know, how do you know at formation if you need to comply or not if you don't have the information at formation to determine if you need to comply or not? So that will be one of the issues that is going to have to get fleshed out. Also, you know, a lot of times business deals change from when you form an entity to when you actually capitalize and begin operations of the entity. So what are the reporting obligations in that instance? Do you just make a good faith guess as to what's going to happen and then you have to update it later? Or what if you form an entity and believe it's going to be owned by an exempt entity, but then it turns out it's not? You know, there are a lot of permutations of the factors that go into determining whether or not you're going to have to first have a reporting company, second, be a beneficial owner of a company, and third, you know, how the applicant has to make reports at the beginning of a life cycle of an entity. Some other exempt entities, government or quasi-governmental entities, and entities expressly exempted by future Treasury regulations. So if there are some other entities that FinCEN drops into the regulations that come out later this year, those would also be considered exempt entities. So as promised, you know, what I view as probably the biggest catch-all implicated by negative inference is if you have an entity that has 20 or fewer full-time employees, not all employees. So if you have a bunch of part-time employees, they're not going to count toward this 20 number. And if you have a bunch of independent contractors working for your reporting company, they're not going to count toward this number. So in order to have an exemption, you have to have all three of these criteria. You have to have 21 or more employees. You have to have $5 million or more in gross receipts for the previous year. And you have to have an operating presence at a physical office in the United States. So if you don't have any of those, so if you have 20 or fewer employees, you have less than $5 million in gross receipts for the prior year, or you don't have a physical office in the United States, you know, you're a virtual company, then you are going to be a reporting company and you're going to be subject to the Corporate Transparency Act reporting obligations. So when I step back to the, you know, State Center, Iowa example, there are, you know, over 100, you know, mom and pop businesses that probably have five or fewer employees that all are now going to find themselves swept into this reporting obligation. Also, you know, the consideration at the bottom, any entity that's newly formed is not going to have $5 million of gross revenue for the prior year because there's no prior year to report. So, you know, the question is, well, does that mean that every entity that's formed after the promulgation of the regulations is going to start out as a reporting company and they can only then try to fit into an exemption in future years after a report's already been made on their behalf?
And that's certainly how it appears, right?
That's how it appears.
Yeah, with the exception of subsidiaries of exempted companies. So that if you're forming a company that fits into one of the other exemptions, the subsidiary, or it's going to be an insurance company, or one of the
that's an open question, Larry. If you're intending to be an insurance company, you're not an insurance company. So do you have to file a report in the period of pendency between when you form the entity and when it gets regulatory approval to be an insurance company? So there's just a lot of gray area that we're going to have to navigate. We've put together just a short list of reporting companies, family offices, probably don't have a lot of employees, they may get swept in. Joint ventures, you know, may get swept in. So even if you have an exempt company in there, you may have a non-exempt company and have to do a reporting for the subsidiary. Main Street mom and pop businesses that use a lot of independent contractors or part-time employees rather than full-time employees. A lot of professional service businesses that have a limited number of owners or limited revenue or only have a virtual presence might get swept into these. And not nonprofit entities that don't qualify and file for 501c status may get swept into this. So one of the other ways that you can get brought into the Corporate Transparency Act is if you are a previously exempt entity and you lose that exemption, then on a prospective basis, you're going to have to be a reporting company and make reports. Similarly, if you're a subsidiary of an exempt entity and because of that, you're an exempt entity, if your parent entity is no longer an exempt entity, then that can throw you into a reporting obligation. You know, one of the interesting aspects of the reporting regime of the Corporate Transparency Act is all of this onus is on the reporting company to report this information, but the reporting company is going to be dependent on third parties to give them the information necessary to make the reporting. And if those third parties don't give them the information that's necessary to make the proper reporting, what do you do? How do you handle that? Do you just file a partial report? Do you note in the report that, you know, you don't have information for these other parties? Does that absolve you from the culpability for the reporting obligations, or is it strict liability? And if it's not reported, then you're guilty and fines start ensuing and possible, you know, criminal sentences could ensue. You know, there's a lot of ambiguity. So one of the things that you're required to do as a reporting company is to update previously reported information if it changes. And you currently have 1 year to do that, although they may come out in the regulations with some criteria that would shorten that period. But right now you have a year to report any changes. So, you know, this could pose a reporting logistics issue for reporting companies. You know, the question is, every time there's a change, do you have to run out and file an update, or can you sit back and wait for a year and see what happens? You know, do you want to just have in your, corporate reminder system that once a year you're going to file a comprehensive amendment for all the changes that happened in the prior year to make it easier on yourself as far as an administrative burden? What happens if, you know, there's a change that causes, say, someone to become a beneficial owner with over 25% at one point in the year, and within that same 365-day period, they are then reduced back down under 25. You have to report them for that period where they were over 25, or if they're back under the threshold before the year is up, is it like nothing happened? You know, those are all open issues yet to be determined. So the beneficial ownership information reported under the Corporate Transparency Act relating to each reporting company is required to be maintained by FinCEN for no fewer than 5 years after the date on which the reporting company terminates. So implicit in that is that somehow FinCEN is going to need to be notified of a corporation's or a reporting company's termination. There's really no direction on how that's going to happen. But it does imply to me that there's going to be more reported on these forms than just name, rank, and serial number for human beings. So, except as authorized by the Corporate Transparency Act and the protocols promulgated under it, beneficial ownership information reported under the Corporate Transparency Act is confidential and may not be disclosed by any officer or employee of the United States, any officer or employee of a state, local, or tribal agency, or any officer or employee of a financial institution or regulatory agency receiving information from the collection under the CTA. Importantly, the beneficial ownership information in the FinCEN database is not going to be subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. So this information is being retained by the government basically to help avoid people being able to avail themselves of the U.S. Governmental process to act nefariously on an international basis. So the information is going to be accessible by federal enforcement agencies. It can be accessed by state and tribal enforcement agencies upon a court order, and it can be accessible by financial institutions if they have permission from their borrower or client to access that information. So I think what's going to happen is you're going to – yep, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say this gets to why I think financial institutions are going to end up being the primary enforcer of this. Their regulatory agencies are charged with determining whether or not the banks are complying with their Know Your Customer rules, and banks have access to the beneficial ownership information for the very purpose of getting to know their customer. And so if the banks ask for the beneficial permission to get the beneficial ownership information, and then they find out that the company hasn't filed, they're going to have to go back and tell the company, we don't have the know your customer information we need. You need to file with FinCEN. So while the CTA was designed to relieve some of the burden from banks, I think banks in the back end will have to end up enforcing it anyway.
Yes. So we're getting close to the end of our hour. I'm going to run through the private penalties portion of this, and I think that will bring us to closure on the points we wanted to talk about today. I think there were some questions raised, and if I want to be respectful of people's time, so if you don't have any questions or you need to leave, feel free to log off at the end of the hour. But if you want to stay on and ask some questions, our panel's available to stay for a couple minutes after to ask any lingering questions. So the CTA makes it unlawful for any person to willfully provide or attempt to provide false or fraudulent beneficial ownership information, including a false or fraudulent identifying photograph or document, to FinCEN, or to willfully fail to report complete or updated beneficial ownership information to FinCEN in complying with the CTA, so a reporting violation. Any person committing a violation is liable to the United States for a civil penalty of not more than $500 for each day that the violation continues or has not been remedied, and may be fined no more than $10,000, imprisoned for not more than 2 years, or both. So that gets people's attention, the person time. However, a person may correct inaccurate information voluntarily and promptly, and in no case later than 90 days after the date on which the person submitted the report, submits a subsequent report containing corrected information. Implicit in that is the ambiguity that what if you find out the information is inaccurate beyond 90 days after it was reported. Presumably, you still need to update the information, but you're out of this safe harbor. You know, what's the consequence? I don't know. A person will not be exempt from penalty if at the time the person submits a report, the person acted for the purpose of evading the reporting requirements under the CTA and has actual knowledge that any information contained in the report is inaccurate. So the people that are filing these reports on behalf of the reporting companies are going to want to make sure that the information they have is accurate and that they're not knowingly delivering any false information to FinCEN. And with that, Emma, did you have a few things you wanted to say?
Yes, thank you. This does conclude today's presentation. A recorded version of this webinar will be available on the Pulsinelli within 24 hours. I'll toss it back to you for any questions.
Okay. Peter and Larry, do we have any other questions that we didn't get to?
No, we've actually walked through all the questions that came during the talk, but if anybody has one now that they want to present, we can try answering them.
Yes, please feel free to submit any questions you may have.
It looks like that's it, Bill.
Acclamation by silence, right? Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We appreciate your attention, and we will let you know when the next round of this information comes out upon FinCEN's issuance of their regulations. Thanks a lot.